conditions. Not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, cause they owned by special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear the same old things they claim.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff, with Eleanor Goldfield. This week on the program, I welcome back media scholar Nolan Higdon. We'll discuss his new podcast, Disinfo Detox, and a recurring special feature, The Gaslight Gazette, that analyzes current events and media coverage of them through a critical media literacy lens, aiming to deconstruct deceptive media messaging. We also discuss legacy media's failure to adequately cover Joe Biden's physical and cognitive decline in the last election, which a new book co-authored by CNN's Jake Tapper addresses, though the authors shift blame from corporate media to the Democratic Party without noting their own role in lack of in-depth coverage, even though there were stories published at the time in the independent press. Later in the program, Eleanor Goldfield joins me as we present another installment of Is This the Best We Can Do?, which analyzes the competency of current government appointees for the positions they fulfill. We'll provide examples regarding the current heads of FEMA, Department of Homeland Security, and the former spokesperson for Biden's Secretary of State, and more. Stay tuned for a new Project Censored show.
All the prisons, build the capacity, citizens, and the times for the master thief, combine, conquer, steal a masterpiece, open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential, fame at the table, then you're probably on the menu. We got that love, we flipped our brothers and our sisters.
Welcome to the Project Censored show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff, with Eleanor Goldfield. Our first guest on today's program is no stranger to the Project Censored audience. It is none other than media scholar Nolan Higdon. Higdon's a founding member of the Critical Media Literacy Conference of the Americas. He is a Project Censored national judge and university lecturer at Merrill College and the Education Department at the University of California, Santa Cruz. All of Nolan's work is available on Substack. He is the author of The Anatomy of Fake News, a critical news literacy education, co-author of Let's Agree to Disagree, a critical guide to communication, conflict management, and critical media literacy, The Media and Me, a guide to critical media literacy for young people. Higdon is a regular source of expertise for CBS, NBC, The New York Times, and the San Francisco Chronicle, telling him any chance he gets what they might do better in their coverage, doing journalism in the public interest. Nolan Higdon, welcome back to the Project Censored show.
Great to be back.
It is wonderful to have you back on the program. You've been really busy, and so I'm glad that we've been able to catch up here in early June. You launched a new program earlier this year that I've had the pleasure of being on. It is called the Disinfo Detox. Nolan, what are you doing on the Disinfo Detox, and where can people find out more?
Yeah, I wanted to launch a podcast, which I guess that puts me in a category with everybody on Earth. But I wanted to launch one where I was able to highlight some of the great, you know, media experts and scholars I know in my life and get them to do interviews about what's in the news right now. So it's a way in which hopefully for folks who don't have the time to sift through all the headlines, they can tune into a quick episode and kind of catch up on what's going on and hear a different viewpoint than we usually get from corporate media. And I try to bring in a lot of guests, not just scholars, but also activists, journalists are on there as well to get some different perspectives. And it's been really cool. It's been cool to connect, and we're doing some new stuff. Dr. Sydney Sullivan and I are launching a new feature on the Disinfo Detox, where we apply media literacy lens to the headlines that are in the news and kind of show people what they can do when they approach news to better protect themselves from some of the propaganda and also better understand the news media.
So you have another feature that you're bringing into the Disinfo Detox, and it's called the Gaslight Gazette, which is sort of a biweekly nonsense detector. We can't use the other term because of the FCC, but I think everybody knows what we're talking about, where you have a biweekly dispatch, and you come right out and say it. It's a dispatch from the front lines of the information war. And you have this on Substack, where each edition uses critical media lens to examine stories and narratives in the news with a goal of spotlighting the falsehoods and propaganda that shape discourse in American media. So, you know, this is a pretty interesting time that we're in, Nolan, where AI-generated propaganda is all around us. And you're looking to try to debunk that. And you mentioned off air, you weren't sure if there would be enough content to do it every couple of weeks. What did you discover, Nolan?
I could immediately put that fear to rest. The first edition of the Gaslight Gazette came out just about 2 weeks ago on my Substack. And it's a biweekly newsletter that's aimed at, you know, saying what's in the news that's false. And it really came from when I was writing the Anatomy of Fake News. to write that book, I was staying constantly up to date on what fake news was in the media. And you and I did that with United States of Distraction as well. But what I was amazed by back then, and this is true before I launched the Gaslight Gazette, we would talk to folks and I would sort of just mention a fake news story. I thought everybody had known it had been debunked, and I'd be the only one in the room who knew that. And so I saw there's a need for it. So I thought, okay, what if I could put out a newsletter that has like the most recent kind of widespread examples of fake news out every 2 weeks and kind of, you know, debunk this stuff in real time instead of waiting, you know, for an academic book to come out 2 years later. But also, you know, it's not just about exposing fake news stories. I also look at some examples of censorship, which is a close friend of fake news. I look at some of the new complications brought about by AI, which are indications of how fake news is going to change and become more complicated in the future. So for anybody who's interested in kind of the flow of information and disinformation and what's in the headlines now, the Gaslight Gazette has been a really cool feature. I've gotten a lot of positive feedback.
One of the things that's just remarkable that seems to be still floating around out there was the issue of imaginary gang tattoos. Can you remind our listeners? And they just double down. I mean, it's like true gaslighter material. Hey, by the way, before you answer that, what's a gaslighter?
Gaslighter is anyone out there who is spreading information that's half truths, false truths, incomplete truths as a way to disorient a person or population so they don't know what's true and what's false. You're gaslit whenever you start questioning your interpretation of reality. That's when you begin.
Two and two equals five, back to George Orwell.
Exactly. Then you start asking yourself, well, does 2 + 2 = 5? Am I wrong?
Are there numbers?
Are we allowed to talk about them? The AI image, I didn't add one part to that story because it's still open-ended. But basically, an individual was arrested and deported under the false pretenses that they were a gang member. And the justification for them supposedly being a gang member was they were wearing Chicago Bulls clothing. And then there was the tattoo on the fingers. And so they showed this image of the tattoo on the hands. But as soon as the individual in question was photographed, folks on the internet noticed there was no tattoos on the hands. And Trump had been carrying what is seemingly an AI-generated image of these hands. But what the reason I said I left something out of that story is there's a big debate, and this is a serious debate. Some people wonder if Trump actually believes the photo is real, if it's someone in his administration who gave it to him. Because some of the things he said in different interviews, it's not clear that Trump really realizes the picture's false. I mean, it wouldn't put it past him to send a false information out there. But that's kind of an interesting part of the story as well, is even, you know, people who are spreading fake news oftentimes believe it.
I mean, look, not that this is fake news, but we're living in a time where the sitting secretary for the Department of Homeland Security completely doesn't know the definition of habeas corpus. You know, later in the program, we'll be talking with Eleanor Goldfield in our Is This the Best We Can Do segment. Then I know that that's going to come up, among other things. But I think part of the whole culture and part of the gaslighting element, it just seems to be one of the main ingredients of the Trump administration, is that these aren't the droids you're looking for. Move along. Don't believe your eyes. Of course, that's not torture. Of course, that's not violating the Constitution. Of course, that's not genocide. It's not like this is new per se in American culture. We've had plenty of administrations playing with reality and the truth, right? But Nolan, in what's referred to as a post-truth world, which I know you and I reject, how far down into this rabbit hole are we into the postmodern normalization of, well, the truth is what feels right to me?
Yeah, I think we're pretty far down this rabbit hole. I say that because, you know, I could easily point to the work that you and I did just 5 or 6 years ago with United States of Distraction. We were pointing out how we got to this moment and warning that if we didn't change course, it would get worse. And I think we've been vindicated in that argument. But I also point out way before us, there were people writing and warning about this every small step of the way. You know, I'm thinking of the Daniel Bornsteins, Morris Berman, yeah. These folks all warned along the way. And even, you know, more recently, Kurt Anderson and these folks. So there was warnings along the way. That look, if you guys are going to cut civics, if you're going to cut education, if you're going to marginalize journalism, if you're going to make people economically desperate, if you're going to allow monopoly power, if you're going to allow abuses and corruption in government without holding folks accountable, i.e. Nixon or Iran-Contra with Reagan or the torture scandals of the Bush administration or the drone murders of the Obama administration, you're going to allow this to get to this point. We're at that point. And It's almost like our worst nightmare has come true. You and I used to say, like, what happens in a world where people don't have media literacy or civics, but, you know, the most strongest economy and military in the world? We're figuring that out. There's constantly media illiteracy on display in this country, whether it's the Signalgate scandal or it's Maha using AI to generate a Health and Human Services report, or there's civic illiteracy on display in this administration constantly. Just today, Marjorie Taylor Greene said she regrets voting for the bill because she didn't know what was in it. Yeah, you're supposed to figure that out before you vote for the bill.
Well, the Patriot Act set that straight. Nobody read the version before they voted on it. It was a different version of it. There's certainly precedent for that. You know, and you and I warned in the prologue of United States of Distraction with the Lao Tzu quote, if you do not change direction, you may end up where you are heading. And for a long time, when you and I would do public events, one of the punchlines was, are we there yet?
Yeah.
Well, gosh, that's not funny at all anymore, because here we are.
We're here. And to your question earlier about the ways in which the Trump administration just fabricates with impunity, this is something different. And you can go back. I've ripped Democrats, Republicans for decades. You have as well. So when I say this is different, it's not attacking the Republicans. But Trump has really used this flood the zone strategy. And I think he realized what most authoritarians always kind of knew, but couldn't get into office to make fruition, which is a lot of the protections we have in our democracy really come from norms, not enforceable laws. So in his first administration, Trump was dealing with a lot of news media, which were, you know, influencing a negative narrative against him. So Trump's solution was don't talk to the news media. Well, leaders talking to the news media is an essential part of democracy. We don't actually have a mechanism to force this administration to be open to the press. And he's really closed ranks. Congress is just an enabler at this point on whatever he wants. He can lie with impunity. And I mean, even like Elon Musk, supposedly just left government. Elon Musk never was recognized by the Trump administration as having a leading role at Doge, even though we watched him on TV have a leading role at Doge. It's that type of Orwellian episodes that we see constantly, but there's no one to hold him accountable.
No, or Musk for that matter. And I mean, you know, we'll be doing a show in the future. We'll have to talk more about the people that are actually, in my view, more influential and dangerous than Musk, including the Peter Thiels, the Curtis Yarvins. The techno-fascists, the dark MAGA crowd. You know, Peter Thiel says the quiet part out loud 15 years ago at a libertarian conference when he talks about our ideology is not popular and won't win elections, but what we'll do is we'll take power with technology. And I think that we've seen the power of technology to corrode and corrupt institutions like the Fourth Estate. Nolan, talk to us a little bit about that, because among the many books you've written, one of the books you wrote was Podcaster's Dilemma. You know, I'm not making light of this. There are very important people that use social media platforms to deconstruct headlines and fill the void where legacy media has failed. But part and parcel, part of the argument of your book was it was just going to sort of imitate the worst elements of corporate media. What do you think about that part of the influencer culture? Because, in all fairness, you're a pundit also. Maybe someone will say, well, Nolan's trying to influence people. What's the difference?
I think it's a fair question. And in the Podcaster's Dilemma, it's a book that's often misunderstood, as you point out, because a lot of it does celebrate the podcast space. I'm a podcaster. I listen to podcasts. I love podcasts. Big fan of the art form. But I, you know, said at that time, like, they're all operating on corporate platforms. They have to give up privacy to be here. They're funding an alternative to corporate media, but what they're funding is going to become the new corporate media. And the new corporate media is not going to make space for people who are questioning corporate power or questioning big tech. And we're seeing that with this consolidation of power. If anybody's paid attention to podcasting the last like 5 or so years, we've very quickly gone from kind of ragtag podcasting with like your iPhone and your drunk buddies into these studios, high broadcast quality. They're on corporate platforms like Spotify that are paying millions of dollars to people. Influencers are getting money from corporate America to flood YouTube and other zones. And so basically, the kind of analogy in the 1980s when television was first started being called a wasteland, a commercial wasteland, that's what's happening
Newton,
now.
That goes back to Newton Minow. That goes back to the 60s.
Yeah, and it's here now. In the digital realm as well. Doesn't mean there's not a lot of great podcasters doing great work, just like there were great people making great like local broadcast television back then. But the corporate consolidation allows them to marginalize those. You don't get advertising, people don't get access, et cetera, et cetera.
So I'd like to remind you all that you're listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Eleanor Goldfield, talking to media scholar Dr. Nolan Higdon. And we're going to use the vehicle right now of a recent article, Nolan, that you wrote, published at The Hill. Too little, too late. A media in crisis blames Democrats for the Biden cover-up. Well, some of our listeners, you know, might say, well, which one? Well, look, recently, our listeners may be aware that CNN talking head Jake Tapper co-authored a book called The Original Sin, President Biden's Decline, Its Cover-Up, and His Disastrous Choice to Run Again. Curiously, people, Nolan, like you and I and others, were talking about this back when it mattered, back when we were wondering how it was happening that they were skipping an entire primary to hoist to the top somebody that not only had problematic policy backgrounds, but someone that really looks more like that they're entering into a retirement phase of a very, very long career in public life, not to be anointed the leader of the so-called free world. But of course, Nolan, since Trump 2.0, much like we saw after Trump 2.1, where the Democrats scrambled to blame anybody and everybody but themselves, Russiagate, etc., we see the same kind of thing going on here with Tapper's book. And you wrote a piece that really talks about, I mean, in short, maybe Tapper's book should have been called Maybe I Ought to Look in the Mirror. What's the thesis of your piece here? And what are we getting at about the failures of the Fourth Estate, Nolan Higdon?
You know, we were bringing this up constantly on different programs and writing. And this is this thing. I mean, when you study media, it happens all the time. You point these things out and it's like a cycle. You get called a conspiracy theorist. And then about 2 years later, people start murmuring the same thing you had been saying 2 years earlier. And then like 5 years later, everyone in the media admits it's true. And they go, well, yeah, we didn't get it right away.
But everyone's right always eventually. Known.
So the book he wrote, Original Sin, with Jake Tapper and Alexander Thompson, or Alex Thompson, they wrote that the Democratic Party are basically responsible, that the people around Biden concealed his decline, and that it really got to the point where it was really bad in 2022, and they lied to the media, and it's all the Democratic Party's fault, and now some people are blaming Jill Biden, et cetera, et cetera. And maybe all that's true. I'm not trying to let any of these people off the hook whatsoever. But the reality is we knew this as the public. The news media knew this. It's not just the news media knew it and didn't report it. It's that the news media knew it and they marginalized and dismissed anybody who brought it up. They treated it like it was some right-wing conspiracy. It was very interesting because this is coming off the first Trump term when so many people in the media were very open to the idea that Trump had cognitive problems. We need to use the 25th Amendment on Trump. But they couldn't apply that same lens to Biden. And I'm no defender of Donald Trump. I made a career out of critiquing the guy. But, you know, Biden was showing a lot more signs of the 25th Amendment being needed than Trump was publicly. And in the book, Tapper is kind of on this mea culpa tour where he's trying to convince or gaslight us that it is the Democratic Party's fault, not the media's fault for being stenographers for those in power. That's what I pointed out in the piece. You can't blame the Democratic Party if you're a journalist. If you're a journalist, you got to blame yourself. You didn't investigate. You didn't corroborate. You didn't do the work that was necessary to report on the story. You got it wrong.
And by the way, we're not making light of people with cognitive decline and people that have conditions. This is not a laughing matter. It's not a joke. And it's not an ad hominem. And it's not a gotcha political attack. It's a legitimate line of inquiry that the Fourth Estate is supposed to vigorously interrogate candidates for public office, let the public know how fit they are to serve, how aware they are. And of course, there's evidence that not only did the leadership of the Democratic Party know that Biden wasn't the most viable candidate, there's now obviously other evidence that clearly shows that these people inside the media could have went in and said, look, the American public has a right to know X. And rather than do that in real time when they had the place, time, and opportunity, we have Tapper now cashing in on a book a couple years later after nothing can be done.
Exactly. And they normalize certain things that now in hindsight look disastrous. The lack of a primary. I know technically there was a primary in terms of votes were cast, but they treated it like a normal event instead of critiquing it and saying like, look, the party is allowing this guy to run away with this thing. He's not debating. He's not doing interviews with us. And even after the debate in June that rightly scared so many people, I don't think the media did a tough enough job to answer the question, who's running the country when this guy does have these freezes? I mean, and those are the kind of questions, like you said, it's not making fun of Biden in any way. But if Biden is freezing up like that, or is lost, or is too tired and work needs to be done, who's doing that work? As a citizen of this country, I want to know who is leading the country in those moments, especially when we have things like terrorism, nuclear warfare, economic collapse, all these threats to our livelihood. You know, we want to know who's at the wheel.
So you write in here about the media knowing about Biden's decline in 2019, and by 2020, it's impossible to ignore, but fearing a Sanders upset in the primary, Democrats and media allies close ranks. You and I have written at length about how the Democratic leadership tanked Sanders' campaign in 2016, arguing legally in court that they could go back to Tammany Hall smoking cigars in a back room and choose the candidates. The public doesn't have a say. I mean, they were just out and out about it. People seem to forget, the United States of Amnesia style, that this is what we're dealing with, the incompetence and corruption at the top of the Democratic Party, which is not an endorsement of the corruption and incompetence of the Republicans, by the way. We can walk and chew gum. It's both and, not either or. But you point out here, Tapper's post facto outrage avoids that whole historical context, as if Tapper wasn't working at CNN covering this all while it was happening. And by the way, many of these stories ended up in Project Censored books because the corporate media weren't openly talking about them, even though the independent press was. And you point out that one of the biggest things that Tapper avoids is his own complicity. Journalism isn't stenography, and he's blaming sources for lying and ignoring his job, which is to interrogate power, not to simply repeat what people in office say.
Exactly. I pointed that out in there because Tapper kept making this excuse, well, the Democrats lied. It's like, how long have you been in journalism? Of course politicians lie. Duh. Jake Tapper's just like, gosh, if there was only some like institution or group of people who could expose those lies, we wouldn't have been lied to that whole time during the Biden years.
It's absolutely incredible. And like his peer, who took the whole weaponization of fake news and the attacks on the media, Acosta, Jim Acosta, another bestseller, basically making it about him. Again, another lost opportunity, but opportunists will often make them about themselves. So there's more narcissism than Donald Trump going on. And I would say Tapper is exhibiting a little of that. He's going to be going on a whole tell-all tour of why the media can save us. Yet he's an exact example of how they don't and didn't.
Yeah, there's been this whole transformation. And I talk a little bit about it in the article over the last 10 or so years, where the media rightly recognized that Donald Trump in his first term was not a popular candidate. In fact, he was hated by half the country in a lot of respects. And so they attenuated their commentary to be negative against Trump. It was really good for ratings. You know, we saw an uptick in media viewership. We saw an uptick in people buying political books. There was an uptick in donations to different organizations. So there was a lot of money to be made critiquing Donald Trump. But the problem is journalism is dependent upon objectivity, or at least appearing to be objective. And so when Trump left office, the media was kind of scrambling for a message. I mean, we have no objectivity. People don't trust us to be objective. And in Trump era 2.0, when Trump's popularity seemingly has increased, at least more so than the Democrats, the media, even when they do expose Trump's lies, which they do some good reporting on Trump, the public just isn't listening anymore. And so you see people like Jake Tapper trying to rewrite history to say like, no, I was always going after power. I was always objective. Or Chris Cuomo is my favorite. He went from playing interference for his brother. He's totally went about face on News Nation, and he sounds like a populist out there.
Yeah, he sounds like a muckraker from the 20th century.
They're all trying to do this to recover their image. And I think that the Trump and Biden years have really been terrible for the media, maybe even worse than the WMD years or the Bush years.
You know, the way to recover your credibility is by acting credibly and not denying that you have a history of sycophancy and chasing profits for corporate media rather than seeking accountability for people in power by informing the American public. You end your piece, Nolan, by saying credibility once lost isn't easily reclaimed, and the damage isn't just to journalism, it's the democracy itself. And I'm afraid that I agree with you. It's not a pretty place, but we can rely on people in the independent press to continue to tell these stories. People need to expand their media diets. They need to really seek out sources that are transparently sourced, that are telling us what's going on, and not get swept up in the din of the constant gaslighting and rewriting of history. Maybe too little too late, but as the title of your piece suggests, we can still have accountability. We can still improve the way in which we're reporting to the public. And I think we really need to do so. That's going to be the main vehicle to what might reform the direction this country is headed. So Nolan, in the last moment we have, share with us where people can find your work follow your work, anything else we need to know.
Yeah, I just want to echo that as well. And anything you can do to support local or independent journalism is great. Like, share, support, give a couple bucks if you've got it to them. You can find me on YouTube at Disinfo Detox, or you can follow my Substack. I'm nolanhigdon.substack.com. You can sign up there, get the newsletter. It goes right to your email. Thank you so much for having me on the show, Mickey.
Absolutely a delight. Nolan Higdon, it's always wonderful to have you on the program, and we'll certainly be catching up with you again, and we'll hear more about the Disinfo Detox and the Gaslight Gazette. Coming up next, I talk with Eleanor Goldfield. Stay tuned. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I am Mickey Huff with Eleanor Goldfield. And in this segment, I am joined by Eleanor Goldfield. This is the segment where Eleanor and I get together and talk about current events through a critical media literacy lens. And we also have had a theme we've been revisiting this year. Is this the best we can do? That's not a rhetorical question. Eleanor and I do think that there are many amazing and capable folks living in the United States of America. We certainly could be doing better in many, many ways, Eleanor. And in fact, sometimes the folks that have been in maybe a previous administration, for example, when they had the opportunity to do the best that they could, maybe they now come forward to tell us later, afterwards, that maybe they could have done something more, or maybe they knew something that they didn't say. You know, maybe something that if they would have done before when they were in a place of public power, that they might have been able to move the needle on really important issues, whether it's domestic or foreign policy. And in this case, Eleanor, I think you want to tell us a little bit about the curious case of Matt Miller. Is that right?
The curious case, yes. Yes, Mickey, absolutely. I'm reminded of a recent book that actually came out by Omar El-Akkad, called One Day Everyone Will Always Have Been Against This. And basically that when it's safe, when your job isn't on the line, when the upholding of the status quo isn't on the line, then you can come out and say things the way that former spokesperson for the State Department under Biden, Matthew Miller, said recently on a Sky News podcast, "I don't think it's a genocide, but I think it is without a doubt true that Israel has committed war crimes." I mean, there's problems with that comment in and of itself, but the real problem here, the reason that so many people jumped on this, Mickey, is because as spokesperson for the State Department, he continuously stood up there and while smiling,
smirking, perhaps?
Yes, smirk is a good way to put that. Basically saying that, no, we have no proof. We have no evidence to suggest war crimes. And he said this for months. And he said in the same podcast, he said, quote, "When you're at the podium, you're not expressing your personal opinion. You're expressing the conclusions of the United States government." The United States government had not concluded that they committed war crimes, still have not concluded that, end quote. I know that people get tired of the Nazi comparison, but let's just, for fun, have this comparison. If you could have heard Goebbels or whoever else saying, "Look, I was just saying what the Nazi regime thought. It wasn't my personal opinion." Would you accept that? Would you say, "Oh, that's fine then. No big deal. You were just saying what the government found"? Also, if this is the case, then where are you getting your information about war crimes from? And if you know that they're committing war crimes, how could the nation with the largest surveillance network in the world not also know that, Matthew? So it doesn't make a tidbit of sense, Mickey. It's absolute garbage. And what's really so disturbing to me is that either he really believes this or he thinks that we're dumb enough to believe it. So again, is this the best that we can do?
My goodness, it's enough to maybe make younger folks cynical. I know that the job of press secretaries is to run interference and promote agendas, and each of the, government agencies and so on have these PR folks and so on. But if I didn't know any better, I would wonder if things haven't gotten weirder and worse in many ways. Speaking of curious cases, we saw serial GOP liar George Santos recently sentenced. You might have missed it in the din and the noise of the culture, but he actually is going to prison for more than 7 years over this serial lying that has just become part and parcel. It's more like the air of American politics that people breathe in and out with great regularity. It seems that almost no one's capable of speaking the plain truth. Not that we're putting on antiquity lenses here, rose-colored glasses for the past, and pretending that there's this bygone glory day when America was great. It does cause consternation to see just such willy-nilly, cavalier expressions coming from people like Miller, who was lying through his teeth, George Santos style. I brought up Santos for a reason. You either are to believe that these people are so dumb and incompetent that they just don't know better, or that in fact their Ivy League pedigrees have thrown on some sheep's clothing, just to see what they can get away with, And I think that maybe even worse than the moral crimes of prevarication, constant, fire hose of falsehoods that stem from these folks in these offices, whether it's under Biden or Trump. I think the real crime is the installation of cynicism in younger people that somehow we can't do better, that these are the leaders. And again, I just don't accept that. I don't think that that's appropriate. And I think we have obligations as media critics, as scholars, as activists, as educators, to really set the record straight and let people know that we don't live in a post-truth world, that facts actually do matter. And it seems like even Matt Miller might be coming around to that position.
And it speaks to this. I'm reminded when I was reading the transcript of this interview that Matt Miller did, it reminded me of Nixon yelling, "Well, I'm saying when the president does it, it's not a crime." And I'm like, well, speaking of history here, it's almost as if that has not changed. So, Matt, when you are standing behind that podium that you spoke about, clearly it's not a crime to lie to the American people, even though you were well aware that Israel was committing war crimes, Israel was bombing hospitals, and all of these things. You were aware of that. So now that you're not behind the podium, you can tell the truth? Well, then what does that suggest about the crime of continuously lying to the American people and, of course, the world? That depends on America's actions. You're really just saying that, A, when you're behind the podium representing the United States government, it is necessary to lie, and it's also okay. But anybody else, kind of like that trope, if the cops are allowed to lie to you, but you can't lie to the cops. We have to be honest, and we have to be complacent. We have to be dutiful patriots, but you don't have to do anything to garner that respect. We're just supposed to accept it, no matter how much you lie, and no matter how much after the fact you admit that you were lying.
It's exhausting, but we definitely do not want to slip into complacency and have a normalization of this process. And it's curious, and you brought up Nixon, the I am not a crook. Well, thanks to the Roberts Court, Trump can walk around and say that, and it's, well, true to a degree. If it's not true, we can at least make it legal. So there's a shifting baseline of this. And again, I think that we should rightfully be skeptical of spokespeople in government. You don't get to quote Ronald Reagan very often, but he said, trust but verify. By the way, let's not forget, we don't want to just point out the Nixons and the Reagans and the Trumps. It's Ivy League attorney Bill Clinton, as president, that was arguing about what the definition of is.
Well, and Matt
We
Miller
was
was
talking.
with the Biden administration, so.
It's extraordinary. But I think that this speaks to a larger challenge in our political culture. And people are caught off guard when they hear people telling the truth. But I fear that people may gradually not be able to recognize what truth actually means or facts mean. And, another case in point, and then we can just take our grab bag from the recent past. Kristi Noem a Department of Homeland Security secretary. I still have a hard time saying that without having the mind be boggled by how those words all fit together under the guise of meaning something positive for us. I mean, it's a mass surveillance apparatus, basically. But Noam came into sharp light again recently because she didn't seem to know what habeas corpus was. So there was an exchange in a Senate hearing recently where Democratic Senator Maggie Hassan asked Homeland Security Secretary Noam if she could define habeas corpus. And you might remember that she said that it was, quote, the right that the president has to be able to remove people from this country, end quote. Eleanor.
So it's actually like the exact opposite of that.
Mind-boggling moments.
And this is one of those moments where I can't believe that the people listening to this didn't just shut everything down, be like, we can't continue. This is just like somebody has to just stop. So a habeas corpus is a legal principle that actually requires the government to come before a judge and provide a reason for detaining and imprisoning people. It's basically that you can't just disappear people without a reason. So it's actually the exact opposite of the thing that she said. So this is really terrifying because if you think that something that's supposed to protect human rights is actually a tool with which to disappear people, this means that you don't just fundamentally not understand what these concepts are, you're actually using them in the opposite direction to facilitate, you know, what we've been seeing here, which is, you know, putting people in jail for, as you spoke to Lauren Harper and Seth Stern on a recent program about, you know, disappearing people for writing an op-ed. And I have to laugh because there's so much to cry about. I can't believe she just literally said the exact opposite. We're not even in the 2 + 2 = 5. We're in the 2 + 2 = counting is not a thing.
And they're invoking the Alien Enemies Act. They're going back centuries. Speaking of centuries, you know, some people may remember, and I know this is ancient history in the United States, but some folks might remember Department of Homeland Security was created under a president named George W. Bush, son of George Herbert Walker Bush, former head of the CIA, vice president under Ronald Reagan, that really helped usher a lot of this in. And one of the things, in addition to the Patriot Act, in addition to creating DHS, the W. Bush administration also brought in something called the Military Commissions Act. And I'm bringing that up because Andy Lee Roth, our editor at large now at Project Censored, former associate director, back in our 2008 book, our number one story was no habeas corpus for any person. The Military Commissions Act aimed to do away. The late, great reporter Bob Perry from Consortium News wrote this story, along with Tom Hartman, that looked at this. And talk about going back centuries. We got to go back to 1215, Magna Carta. These people are trying to erase. Kristi Noem's most recent iteration of this is maybe among the most absurd. The MCA actually tried to make arguments. Noam just basically flips out and just says, nope, this is what it is. I'm going to make it up on the fly to conform to whatever it is I want it to mean. But the fact that these people are so shameless that they can do it at a Senate hearing with cameras on, with a bunch of other educated people in the room that obviously had to know what habeas corpus was or they wouldn't be there. Like you said, if this kind of nonsense would take place somewhere else, someone would stand up with a gavel and just say, I'm sorry, we've got to go to lunch. Let somebody take that person aside with a dictionary. I mean, and here we are, you know, making fun of it as if it's satire. We're jumping all the sharks here.
I mean, if there's so much to cry about, you have to laugh. Interestingly enough, there's a law professor at Georgetown University who recently spoke about this, Steve Vladek, and he talks about how there is actually a loophole. Because, of course, there is. It's law. There is actually a suspension clause which states that the privilege of the writ of habeas corpus shall not be suspended unless, kind of like the 13th Amendment, unless when in cases of rebellion or invasion, the public safety may require it. So here's the thing. Kristi Noem actually had a loophole, even though, of course, immigrants existing is not a threat or an invasion or a rebellion. But she actually had a loophole that she could have invoked, but she didn't. She just completely misunderstood what habeas corpus is. And in fact, this suspension clause has been used in the United States. It was used 4 times, as far as I'm aware. In 1861, during the Civil War. In 1871, when the Ku Klux Klan was committing mass violence in the South. In 1905, during a rebellion against American military in the Philippines, which we have feelings about that. And in 1941, in the midst of the bombing of Pearl Harbor. Now, here's the thing, though. The suspension clause, and this is where we get into what the Trump administration is trying to do in terms of blurring the lines or even taking over other branches of government. The suspension clause can only be invoked by Congress. It cannot be invoked by the president. So regardless of what Trump has said, or regardless of whether anyone in that administration knows what these two words mean, Congress can only invoke this. Now, when I first read that, my initial reaction was, well, technically, Congress is the only one that can say we're at war. But that line has been very much blurred in the past 20 years. So it is very scary, I think, Mickey, because we see already that there has been the precedent, which also speaks to the importance of contextualizing Trump's administration and their ability to do the damage that they're doing. We see that the United States government, the executive branch, has a history of taking control of things like war and has been placing that in the hands of a single person, i.e. the president. So it seems like there is precedent to take things like this suspension clause and just say, hey, well, now the president can be the one to say we're at war. Why can't the president also be the one to say that there's a suspension clause vis-a-vis habeas corpus against whoever we choose?
And there's another Miller, of course, that comes into play here. That would be Stephen Miller in the White House. That was also the one that was floating, suspending the right to habeas corpus altogether, which, by the way, is about any person, not even citizenship. It's about any person. And again, just to punctuate this segment before we take a quick break, only Congress, not the president, can suspend habeas corpus. But of course, Stephen Miller's not listening to this show. Anyway, Eleanor, with that, let's segue out of this and talk about another way in which we can look at, is this the best we can do? So I'd like to remind you all that you're listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Eleanor Goldfield. It's that time of the month when Eleanor and I are talking about the headlines through a critical media literacy lens. We're talking about, sort of under our theme, is this the best we can do, where we highlight the lowlights of what we see happening in the public sector, and obviously suggesting that we could be doing a lot better than we are, Eleanor. And we seem to have a kind of topsy-turvy, bizarro, upside-down world. We just got done talking about how the Department of Homeland Security had no idea what habeas corpus was. There's certainly some other things that we can discuss. And one is our ongoing infatuation. You recently had a really great piece, sort of a great quasi-rant, where you were talking about our infatuation with and sometimes control by celebrity culture in the United States. Talk a little bit about that and how we've allowed in many ways that culture to completely infect all sectors of our culture.
Absolutely, Mickey. So I think this has cropped up several times over the course of the past couple of years. And of course, before that, too. But I think a lot of people are really looking to celebrities to have a comment about what's going on in Gaza. So here's the thing. I worked in recording studios for 10 years in LA. I saw a lot of celebrities, and I can tell you that we ask too much of celebrities. Celebrities should not be the go-to for everything from what you're supposed to eat to what you're supposed to think about international affairs. They're really good at, you know, fill in the blank, dancing, singing, acting, whatever. But this idea that celebrities should light the way for everything that we think and do is absurd. It's not fair to us, and it's not fair to them either. And here's the thing. I'm not saying that, you know, celebrities should not have political ideas. Everyone should have, and does, really. Everyone does and should have a political perspective. Now, in an ideal world, that political perspective would be based on critical media literacy and the understanding of what you're taking in and taking it in from a lot of different sources. And understanding framing and things like that. That'd be in a perfect world. But I'm not saying that, because a lot of people like to say, oh, that celebrity should just shut up and sing or whatever. It's just that, you know, despite People magazine having a section that says celebrities. They're just like us. They're not. Okay. They live in a world that is surrounded by wealth and surrounded, by the way, also by people who do nothing but say, oh my gosh, you're so smart, pretty much 24/7. And so this leads to an analysis that betrays their station in life. And I just think that it's really important that we not look to them to talk about the struggles of people who live off of less than a dollar a day or are being ethnically cleansed or whatever the case may be, because their framing is based on their lived experiences, which are, for the most part, wildly different than ours will ever be. And I think this really speaks to also this issue that we have with American exceptionalism, that we want to be close to celebrity. We see ourselves as just one lottery ticket away from being a celebrity and being rich and famous. And that's not the reality. As soon as we see our framing as a better representation of where we exist in the class structure, in the imperialist structure, what have you, I think we can understand that celebrities, fine, listen to them dance or sing or whatever it is, listen to their diet tips or what have you, if you feel like it. But the idea that they should be the ones to light the way in terms of a class analysis or a anti-capitalist analysis, anti-colonial analysis, is absurd. And so I think we really need to detach ourselves from thinking that celebrities have the answers to everything.
You know, I'm also historically inclined to go back. This isn't, of course, new in American culture. It's just the degree to which that it's basically subsumed most things is rather extraordinary. After all, we have had TV and movie Hollywood presidents, whether it's Reagan, the governor, the governator, right, Arnold Schwarzenegger in California, other examples. Of course, we now have, again, the reality TV president. And in many ways, what we see happening with Elon Musk, you know, celebrity billionaire. I was reminded reading this book again, The Image by Daniel Boorstin from 1961, where he really talks a lot about, under the guise of pseudo events, he has whole swaths of the book that talk about celebrity culture. And coming out of the 1950s, we're also reminded of Vance Packard and the Status Seekers. Another book in the 50s, Will Freeman's Big Name, talks about how people can capitalize on celebrity and how you can use celebrity endorsements to build your political brand. None other than John Kennedy, then Senator of Massachusetts in 1958, running for Senate. This is obviously before he ran against Nixon for president 2 years later. He wrote in a then relatively obscure publication called TV Guide. Kennedy warned that TV was an amazing tool, but the warning part was he worried about what would happen if it got into the hands of someone with more demagogic tendencies, as it were. And it's interesting that Kennedy actually ended up himself using TV during the debate to kind of edge out over Nixon. It was undeniable, the visual element of politics. And Kennedy himself really becomes an American celebrity, as it were. People forget that he was not very popular at the time politically. He came from a controversial family. But the hagiographic sort of vision that we see in reverse, you know, really kind of puts Kennedy as more of a celebrity president with Marilyn Monroe. So I think it's really important, too, that Boorstin also reminds us that a celebrity is simply someone known for their well-knownness. You know, again, I think we are so addled with this. And, you know, I'm teaching journalism, seeing many, many young students who are interested in journalism, but they all talk about influencers. And influencer is the career path. Content creation is now a substitute for journalism? Mm-hmm. I don't think so. Journalism is guided by a Society of Professional Journalists code of ethics. I don't want to belittle influencing. I don't want to belittle content creators of the internet. That's not my purpose here. My purpose is to say that journalism is different. A free press, particularly an independent free press, would be having conversations, I think, like we're having, to really try to tell the public what's going on, to remind the public of things that maybe we've forgotten. Or as I often quip, it's difficult to forget things we're not taught. And right now, there's 47 of the 50 states with legislation or legislation pending to somehow restrict the teaching of our past to mm-hmm. our young people. And that's mm-hmm. ballooned from half a few years ago. Banned books. Again, we saw a little dip this last year. and a slight decline of challenges to books, but that's after several years of record highs of trying to control what people see and read. There was a very disturbing court case not long ago coming out of New Orleans, dealing with the state of Texas, saying that the public does not have the right to know. In other words, it's fine for librarians to pull books if someone doesn't like them, and the public doesn't have a right to petition that for their right to know in the public space. So all of this, I guess, kind of way around the saying that celebrity culture is sort of vapidly imposed on all corridors of our fading democratic republic, Eleanor. And I don't think it bodes well for us, but I also think that teaching and through education, I think that it's no accident that there's a massive attack against education from this administration. There's an attack on the press. There's an attack on legacy media, not just independent. There's an attack on nonprofit. It's clear to me that this is a very calculated anti-intellectual administration. And for all we have criticized and could say about the previous administration, they certainly did not go as far as we're seeing by a long shot in terms of what we're seeing go on right now. Eleanor, we have a few minutes left in this segment, and I know that there's at least one or two more things you wanted to bring up.
I want to touch on the education aspect, but first, just with regards to the celebrity culture, I know that some people might counter by saying, well, look, you've got people like Roger Waters, you know, people who have been very outspoken, Susan Sarandon, about Gaza. And that's helpful because then people who love their music or love her movies will be engaged to look deeper. That's great. I think the important thing here is that I'm not saying that you should never look at celebrities, because I'm also not that boring of a human being. I watch movies too, okay? I listen to music, right? I just know that there's a difference between having these people be your experts on something and appreciating an art form or what have you. And I think, you know, with Roger Waters, for instance, he'll gladly tell you, okay, well, this is where I'm getting my information. And so you can then look at that, and that's great. But I think it's important that everyone cite their sources, celebrities included. And I think that we need to place less stock onto what celebrities say. Now, with regards to the education aspect, I think if you could look at history, wherever we're seeing these authoritarian regimes, they always zero in on education. And the reason is, I think this quote was attributed to Goebbels, how wonderful it is for governments that people do not think. And what you're supposed to be taught in school is to think, not what to think, but to think. And this is very dangerous for authoritarian regimes, because at some point people are going to read something where they go, wait, why does it have to be this way? And then all of a sudden you have a rebellion against an authoritarian regime. And the other point of this is that I think we have to look at the degradation historically of education in this country. And again, to your point, of course, Trump is doing something far worse than we've seen and far more coordinated and targeted. But for instance, there's people in power today that don't know things that one would argue they should have learned in kindergarten. So for instance, the head of FEMA, David Richardson, said in a meeting, a FEMA meeting, that he was unaware that the U.S. had a hurricane season. Now, I have never worked for FEMA. I have no connection, but I knew that there was a hurricane season, and this is something I learned in school like a long time ago. Another thing that David Richardson said in leaked audio from FEMA meetings was that he didn't know how big Texas was. And I quote, I'm not kidding, this is a direct quote. The other day I was chatting with my girlfriend. She's from Texas. She's got like huge red hair. I don't know why that's important to know. And I said something and she said, well, you know, Texas is bigger than Spain. I didn't know that. So I looked at the map. Texas is huge. I mean, if you put it in the middle of Europe, it takes up most of Europe, end quote. I mean, Mickey, I wish I was reading from Mad Libs or The Onion, but this is a head of a disaster agency that doesn't know the size of Texas and also doesn't know that there's a hurricane season. Our education system has failed across the board, and now it's getting set up to fail even more.
So, Eleanor, you'll be delighted to hear that back to our talk of press secretaries and the jobs that they do. We're speaking Wednesday, June 4, and this will air later. Press secretary for the Trump administration said that the FEMA head was joking. So now we're back to, oh yeah, disasters are hilarious. Why not crack more jokes about them as we approach what have been deadlier and deadlier hurricane seasons? Again, this phrase is overused in this segment, but it does boggle the mind. Is it incompetence rising to the top? Pete Hegseth, et cetera. Are we really in this much of an intellectual deficit at the upper rungs of government? Or is this, again, sort of a ruse, a joke, a bad joke being played out on
an
everyone?
An awkward gesture. I mean,
yeah. So again, we're back to cynicism and skepticism. I will remain skeptical, but I refuse to become cynical because I don't think this is the best we can do. And I think by calling it out and sometime infusing a little bit of dark humor is how we get through the day. But I think it's important to note that these kinds of situations are happening across our government. They shouldn't be tolerated and they surely shouldn't be normalized, Eleanor. So anyway, we are here at the end of another segment of Is This the Best We Can Do on the Project Censored Show. Eleanor, any parting words for our audience today?
I appreciate you reminding folks and reminding me that this should never be normalized. And while we can joke about this, this really represents a serious issue. And we have to remain vigilant in calling this out and doing better. Because as you pointed out at the beginning of this segment, there are so many brilliant people in this country, so many
really
people
are.
Who know how to address these problems, who have the answers. That's who we need to go to.
Absolutely. And with that, I'm Mickey Huff with Eleanor Goldfield. Thanks for tuning in to another episode of the Project Censored Show. We'll see you next time.
We want to smash, crash, bash, mash, blast the system. We want to get it hype, get it live, get with the mission. We want the crowd loud, fist pumping, rhythm is hitting.
That does it for another episode of the Project Censored Radio Show on Pacifica Radio. I've been your host for this week's show, Eleanor Goldfield, along with my co-host, Mickey Huff. I am also the associate producer of this program, and our executive producer is Anthony Fest. For more information about all of the things that Project does, from the radio wave to the classroom, please check out projectcensored.org. I'd also like to remind listeners that the views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and hosts and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of Project Censored. This broadcast is intended for educational purposes as part of our mission to promote critical media literacy, independent journalism, and civic engagement. We aim to foster thoughtful dialogue and encourage listeners to think critically about the information they receive from all media sources. Project Censored is a 501c3 nonprofit organization and does not endorse or oppose any candidate for public office. We have a lot of tools, resources, and information over at our website at projectcensored.org. Please also follow us on social media just before we get deplatformed at Project Censored. As always, thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Political ties, habitual lies, alibis, disguise, another guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide, wars, fall for little poison. The weapons manufactured paid for by attacks upon the prisons and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, build the capacity, citizens, and the times for the master thief.
This is America. This is America.
This is KPFA 94.1 FM, and you're invited to witness resistance in real time. Saturday, June 14th, from 1 to 3 p.m., we go live from the streets of San Jose. Join hosts of Flashpoints, Dennis Bernstein, and Miguel Gavilan Molina for a special broadcast.
Broadcasting resistance, summer of rage.
As military fanfare fills the streets, communities are pushing back. With voices of dissent, immigrant rights, healthcare justice, youth organizing, and frontline resistance. Tune in for powerful interviews and raw sound from the ground. Because this summer,
silence is not an option.
Only on KPFA 94.1 FM and KPFA.org.
There are no algorithms behind this mic. No soulless scripts, no clickbait content, just human voices telling stories that matter with impact. KPFA is people-powered. Hosts challenge power. Journalists investigate and question power. DJs still spin vinyl with intention. And listeners like you, who choose the human signal over the digital noise. KPFA, people-powered, listener-funded, and always real.
Love. This is the one that's never going to give up. 94.1 KPFA, 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno. Online at kpfa.org. All thanks to you, the listener.